It's 12:35 at the Big 550 KTRS. Hello again, it's Paul Harris in the middle of the day, in the middle of America, doing talk radio for people who never thought they'd listen to talk radio. And it's only here on the Big 550 KTRS. And don't forget, portions of the show do appear in real audio on my website, harrisonline.com. We're going to be bringing back the streaming audio for the whole station. When is that happening, Chris? Any day now, right? Maybe before the end of the week? Cool. By popular demand. Hope to have that back by the end of this week. In the meantime, there are select portions of the show, like John Max's Friday appearance and James Rocky's movie stuff and Aaron Barnhart's TV stuff. You can get those anytime on harrisonline.com, along with my regular column, Just Plain Harris. I just put one up over the weekend about the Department of Duct Tape Security. You can subscribe to get that column for free via email, like thousands of people already do, and read the most recent one. Instructions are all right there on harrisonline.com. You'll also want to click on the picture of the day. And while you're there, click on the book of the week. The book of the week this week on harrisonline.com is called This Just In, What I Couldn't Tell You on TV, written by veteran CBS newsman Bob Schieffer. His title now is Chief Washington Correspondent for CBS News. He's also the host of Face the Nation for the last 12 or so years. And I'm guessing for the last 24 hours or so, he's been the chief shoveler at home. How many inches of snow you got there in Washington, Bob?
I'm telling you, Paul, I was listening to your intro where you're saying you're in the middle of America, and I'm telling you, we are in the middle of the North Pole. You have never seen such a storm as we've had blow through the nation's capital here. We've got about 2 feet of snow, 2 to 2.5 feet of snow.
Wow.
Everything is shut down completely. I tried to run a little errand just a while ago, and it was literally, I mean, I needed the dog sled. We haven't had anything around here like this in 10 years, and it has completely shut this town down.
Did it affect people getting to your show yesterday morning?
Well, no, it wasn't as bad yesterday morning. I mean, I came in a four-wheel vehicle, but, I mean, yesterday was nothing. I mean, we got about 1.5 feet of snow overnight, and we had about 1 foot or maybe a little more in some places on the ground before this latest wave rolled in. And it's just not to be believed.
Wow. Well, you know, Washington has already been in crisis mode for, you know, ever since 9/11. And
yeah.
And now having this on top of it has just got to make that town nuts.
Well, you know, I mean, the town was already nuts.
Yep.
Because we had just gone through this duct tape scare that
yeah.
we all went through last week. And then, of course, before that, we had this sniper that had terrorized the town, and
mm-hmm.
before that we had the anthrax, and then, way back when, it seems like now, 9/11. I mean, I want to tell you, I mean, my hat is off to the folks who live here. They have really, I mean, I live here, but it's been some tough times for everybody.
I watched you yesterday, and you had Tom Ridge, the
yeah.
The Secretary of Duct Tape Security.
Secretary of Home Depot, that's what they call him here.
I noticed when you were asking him the duct tape questions, he didn't want to look you in the eye. Do you think he and the people in his department are a little embarrassed about that
well,
anxiety level last week?
Let me just say to start, Tom Ridge is a good man, and he's a good citizen, and that goes without saying. But this, I don't know what went wrong, but they have gotten this so tangled up. I mean, first they come out and tell people around here, you need to get the duct tape, you need to get the plastic sheeting, we go through all this. It really put people on edge. I mean, we had this run on all the hardware stores, and then Ridge comes back on Friday and says not to worry.
Right.
You know, don't be alarmed, just taking a little precaution. And I know this is a very delicate thing. It's a dangerous thing. Let me tell you, I'm one of those who believes this threat is real. I don't want to downgrade the threat. But the way they have handled this about trying to show us how to get prepared, I mean, they really need to get their act together.
Do you know what it was that they expected last week or what they still expect?
No. I mean, I don't know any more than you do about it. Apparently, they were thinking that at the end of the Hajj, which is one of the Muslim holy periods, as it were, they were expecting something there. And there have been everything from reports that there would be assassinations of congressional leaders to talk about chemical and biological weapons. Again, yesterday, I kept asking Secretary Ridge over and over, can you give us a little more specifics on this? And he couldn't give any. So it's a real question in my mind as to was it that had set them off? Apparently, it was something quite serious, and apparently, there had not been anything like this since the days before 9/11. But
wow.
The way they went about explaining it, I must say, leaves a lot to be desired.
And do you think the media has to take any responsibility for the anxiety level that it caused last week, or was it just reporting what the government told you?
You know, in this case, I don't. And there are times when I think the media does bear responsibility when things go haywire. But this time, no. I mean, what else could we do? I mean, the people at the Department of Homeland Security, that's supposed to be the department that's telling us how to protect the homeland, call a news conference. I mean, we didn't ask them. They called a news conference and announced that these are the things you ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And by just laying it out, and then people went and did what they advised them to do, how could they expect it to be otherwise? I mean, they didn't couch this in anything. They just said, you know, we've had these threats coming in. Here's what you ought to do. And this time I had to plead not guilty on the media being involved. And I don't always take that position, let me tell you for sure.
All right, let's get away from that threat and talk a little bit about the potential for war for just a minute here. I'm a big fan of your work, and I love the work especially that you and Rather do, seeing the two Texas boys throw stuff back and forth at each other. Before we even get to the war, let me ask you, as a Texas boy yourself, grew up there, worked there, had your first job at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, do Texans consider George W. Bush a Texan?
Yes. They do not consider his father a Texan, though.
Uh-huh.
His father has an accent, as we all know. George W. Bush talks like we do. And in all seriousness, you know, his father grew up in Connecticut. He came to Texas to make his fortune, which he proceeded to do. But young George Bush, the current president, grew up in West Texas, and he talks like a fellow from West Texas, and in a funny kind of way, he thinks like a person from West Texas. He is quite different from his father, who I always thought of as a very good public servant, but not a very good politician, and not one who seemed to like politics. This George Bush likes politics. He likes to play the game, and I must say, I think he's pretty good at it. He's one of the shrewdest politicians that I've run across.
All right, that leads to my question about this Bush, this President Bush, and the potential for war. As I said, I watch you a lot, and I saw you after the State of the Union say that this President Bush didn't leave much wiggle room.
He didn't.
So where are we now a month after the State of the Union?
I think we're headed to war, to be quite frank, and I'm sorry I have to say that, but that's the way it looks to me. He did not leave much wiggle room. He said, unless Saddam Hussein disarms, we intend to disarm him. And as far as I'm concerned, it's now in Saddam Hussein's court. I think he, at this point, is the only one that can stop military action. Now, my hope is, and I think like most Americans, we'd like to see this done under the umbrella of the United Nations. But I think if this administration continues to believe that Saddam Hussein is posing a grave threat to our national security, they'll go in there whether the United Nations says go or not. And it seems to me, and this is a part that one only hopes Saddam Hussein understands, we have moved to the point here where unless he leaves and takes this band of robbers and thieves with him, I think we have no alternative but to go, because if we don't, it will look as if that he has stared us down and has won, and to me, that would be the most dangerous situation of all.
Bob, you've reported on American foreign policy and American wars for 4 decades now. You even went over to Vietnam to cover Texans in that war.
Yeah.
What do you make of the anti-war movement? There were big demonstrations all over the world over the weekend. What do you make of that, and compare it to the ones that you remember from the Vietnam era?
Well, I think in the Vietnam era, we sent people off to Vietnam without any clear understanding of why they were going or what they were supposed to do. In this case, for me anyway, I understand what this is about. I mean, we were attacked, and we were attacked in this country, in our homeland. I lost 3 people who were friends of mine on 9/11, so it's a very personal thing with me. I do believe there's a threat out there. I do believe there's a connection between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden. And I believe he does pose a threat. And people say, well, what was the final straw for you? And I'll tell you what it was. When when Colin Powell went before the United Nations and made the case, I thought the strongest part of the message was the messenger, because Colin Powell was the most reluctant warrior of all. He's the guy who's been in the service. He's the guy who's been shot at. He's the guy who's written letters home to the parents of young people who were killed in war. He knows what this is all about. When he put his stamp on it and said, I think this is something that we're going to have to take this guy out unless he leaves, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt for a while.
Yeah, and when Colin Powell says it, it changed my mind seeing him make that presentation, because this is a guy of the highest integrity, and I think that this is a guy who wants to take the moral high ground at all times and doesn't play politics. He's not going to let himself be forced into saying something he doesn't believe.
Well, that's what I think. And, I mean, you know, he doesn't need this job. I mean, you know, Colin Powell's going to be able to make a living. People say, well, maybe he's just, you know, going along because, you know, he's made his case and now he's trying to be a good soldier. I agree with you. I do not believe Colin Powell would do something that he thought was morally wrong. And I think Colin Powell, being a soldier, would think it would be morally wrong to put young Americans in harm's way unless he thought there was no other alternative, unless he thought the cost of doing nothing was worse than the cost of doing what we're going to do.
All right.
But, you know, I must say, I still hold out a faint hope, and I think there's a faint hope within this administration that until the very end, that Saddam Hussein may eventually go.
But all that said, back to the anti-war movement.
Well, that's right, and I should have answered your question because you asked. I don't know what to think. I think that in this case, I think that people are looking for ways not to become involved militarily. I think a lot of this is resentment toward the United States because we're just the last superpower. And, you know, you kind of hate to say it, but when you live in the biggest house on the block, some of the people who live in the smaller houses are always going to be against you and be mad at you, no matter what you do. And I think part of this goes right to that. The French at this point seem to be on a course of just whatever we want to do, they want to do something differently. And whatever their reasons for that, I mean, I think they're wrong in this case, but they certainly have a right. They certainly have a right to do that. I can almost understand the opposition in Germany more than I can understand the opposition that has arisen in France. In Germany, I mean, let's face it, these are people who remember World War II and remember what their country had become, and I think it's only natural you might see something of a reaction to that and an aversion to war. And I can understand that. The French, I find at this point, just inexplicable.
It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with CBS newsman Bob Schieffer, the host of Face the Nation and CBS News' chief Washington correspondent and author of This Just In, What I Couldn't Tell You on TV. And I know a little bit about this guy because I know some people who work in television. For instance, Bob, I know that your CB handle used to be Anchorman.
It did. But, you know, I had that handle until my dear friends Roger Mudd and Tom Brokaw forged a letter and signed, got Richard Saland, at that time my boss, to sign it. The poor man didn't know what he had signed, and they sent it to me, and in this letter, Mr. Saland instructed me not to use the handle Anchorman because I was only a correspondent, and pointed out in this letter, which they had caused him to sign without knowing what was in it, pointed out that people like Roger Mudd and Tom Brokaw were Anchormen, but I wasn't.
Yeah.
And but I got back at both of them.
Yeah, I understand that you're a real practical joker. You write in the book, as a matter of fact, about a practical joke you used to like to play on the Pentagon brass when you worked there.
Oh, yeah. That was one time in those days, the security people would sometimes go through our desk, and it infuriated me. And so I got one of these top secret document covers that you have to put on top of any document that's classified top secret before you put it in a safe, and I just put it on my notebook, and when I'd go to news conferences, I would very grandly raise up the cover that said Top Secret and take notes behind it. Jerry Friedheim, who was a public affairs officer for the Pentagon in those days, called me in one day, and he said, Bob, would you please stop doing that? He said, I know it's a joke, and you know it's a joke, but he said, Admiral Thomas Moore, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, every time he sees you do that, he calls me up and reams me out. Please stop. So I did.
I like that. What is the hardest story you've ever had to cover?
Oh, I think, well, there were two, really, and they're kind of the bookends of this book, and that is the assassination of President Kennedy, and I was kind of on the scene there, and it was just a terrible story to cover. Nothing like that had ever happened in this country, and I left it just drained of all emotion, but maybe even harder was 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every single CBS News person who went to Ground Zero that day had a near-death experience. The man who directed our television coverage thought his own daughter had been killed.
Mm.
The youngest member of our CBS News staff was standing in the middle of the newsroom and saw the plane hit the tower where her father worked, and she never saw him again. And in Washington, I was en route up to the Capitol, where I spend most of my days, and the bureau chief called me on the phone and said, where are you? And I said, I'm trying to get to the Capitol. I'm at the foot of Capitol Hill, and the traffic's so bad that I can't get there. And she said, get out of there. We think there's another plane headed to Washington. We think this one is headed for the Capitol. And that, of course, was that plane that those passengers in Pennsylvania forced down. So, you know, who knows? If they had not done what they did that day, perhaps I wouldn't be talking to you today. And I want to tell you, I think about that every single day.
I've, as I said, watched you do things through the years, and I can remember vividly a moment several years ago at the height of the Clinton impeachment story.
I know where you're going.
when you and many other TV news people had to try to rush onto the air with the Star Report results when it was released to the press.
And we hadn't seen it in advance, of course, and we were getting it page by page and trying to get through that without saying something that you shouldn't ought to say on television.
Now, that's what I want to ask you. How explicit was what you were reading and that you had to kind of filter before you could say it out loud to us?
I mean, it was, look, I used to play baseball in college. I've been around a lot of sports locker rooms in my life. I was a police reporter for years at the Fort Worth Star-Telegraph. I know most of these words. There's not many words in the English language that I haven't heard. But this was some of the gamiest stuff that I believe I've ever laid eyes on. And, I mean, I found myself and Larry King. I was on Larry's broadcast last night, and they played back some of the clips of me that afternoon. It was absolutely hilarious. I'm talking to Dan Rather, and I say, and Dan, and then she said he put his hand up her sweater, and then... And then I say, Dan, I think we better stop this hand right there. I mean, it was just impossible. I finally came to one point, and then I said, and then they had sex of a kind. Now, I have never used that phrase in my life. I don't know where it came from, but just somehow in the back of my mind, it just popped out because I just couldn't imagine myself saying some of this stuff on television. Now, of course, you know, it's we kind of say that kind of stuff all the time. It seems to me like that right there we had a kind of a dividing line where we just sort of, and I think really that's the worst thing that Clinton did, really, was he just sort of coarsened our culture, he and his pursuers, when they took us through that episode. I mean, think now of the questions that parents get asked by 10-year-old children. I mean, think of the words that we use at dinner parties and so forth. It's just different today than it was then, and I think that's one of the reasons.
Do politicians press you a lot when you're running around Washington? Do they press you? I've got to come on Face the Nation. I've got my agenda, and I want to get it out there.
You know, one of the great things about Face the Nation, I always say it's the greatest job in journalism. For the first time, they come to you. You don't even have to come to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's true. People do like to get on television. And these Sunday morning programs, and not just Face the Nation, but I Meet the Press as well, these are the last places, really, on network television where people can come on and have a serious discussion and lay out their views on important issues. I mean, we don't do a lot of shouting. We don't do a lot of finger-pointing on Sunday morning. We really are a serious broadcast. I mean, I try not to take myself too seriously, but I want to keep that program just the way it is because it really does serve a purpose. It used to be in Washington when people had an idea they wanted to float, they would go to one of these, what I call the super colonists, the James Restons, the Alsop brothers, people like that. Now, what they do is they come on these Sunday programs, and so they do sort of play a part in the national dialogue now, and I'm very proud of that.
Oh, well, you should be proud, and one of the things you should be proud of is that you don't let people get away with stuff. Like yesterday, Ridge didn't want to answer your questions about duct tape, and you kept coming back to him and pressing him on that, and I admired that. I like the way you handled that. There is so much other stuff I'd love to talk to you about. I hope we have a chance to do it again in the future, but good luck with the book, which, as I've told you, I've made the book of the week on my website, and I hope it just sells a ton because it is full of just great stories.
Well, you know, if I could brag just for a second, this Sunday it was number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. It made its debut, and for me, that's kind of an out-of-body experience, I'm here to tell you. So thanks so much, Paul.
Congratulations. I hope it goes to number 1.
Okay.
Bob Schieffer from Face the Nation and CBS News here on the Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS.